Yeah, well, it was connected to what we were talking about, because we were talking about resurrection and the fact that, you know, we're used to the situation where we're all in our natural bodies here and there aren't any resurrected people running around, and we're used to the idea in the eternal state that everyone's got a glorified body, but there's this kind of halfway house situation, for lack of a better phrase, in the millennial kingdom, where you have a mix of people who are still in their natural bodies and procreating, and you have people who have been raised from the dead as well. Those two together, kind of like after Jesus is raised for the 40 days, he's in the midst of regular old people, but he has his glorified, resurrected body. So we ended up talking about aspects of that last week, and that was all Riley's fault. But it was a good, which was really Meg's fault.
Yeah.
It was Riley's fault and Meg's fault. And, which was really the puppy's fault. But
because she wasn't here to ask you herself.
That's right. Yeah, so the puppy's involved as well. But anyway, so are there any comments or questions about that before we go into what the rest of the passage? All right. So who would like to get us started by reading in 1 Corinthians 15, verses 29 through 34?
Forward.
All right.
29 through 34. Otherwise, what will those do who are baptized for the dead? For if the dead are not raised at all, why then are they baptized for them? Why are we also in danger every hour? I protest, brethren, by the boasting in you, which I have in Christ Jesus our Lord, I die daily. If from human motives I fought with wild beasts at Ephesus, what does it profit me? If the dead are not raised, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. Do not be deceived. Bad company corrupts good morals. Become sober-minded as you ought, and stop sinning. For some have no knowledge of God. I speak this to your shame.
Thanks, David.
Yeah.
So he's kind of coming back to this idea again that he started quite a while ago, where people were saying there's no resurrection. So he talked about the resurrection and talked about other things, and now he's coming back and saying, you know, otherwise, if there isn't a resurrection. And then he's continuing back to that idea of what the implications are. So we have one of these pretty puzzling verses here, verse 29, right? Mentions baptism for the dead. And I've heard one person who was teaching on it say there's like 200 different interpretations of what that might mean.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's all sorts of ideas. But, so we probably aren't going to cover all 200. But several things to notice about what he's saying there. he uses the pronoun they. What would they do who are baptized for the dead? If the dead do not rise, why then are they baptized for the dead? So one of the things we need to recognize is he's not saying that's the practice that Paul's involved with, right? He's talking about other people. And so then there's kind of a fork in the road that interpreters take on this as to whether or not he's just talking about examples of other pagans or other pagan practices that people do where they believe in an afterlife. So one view is that he's referring to pagan practices at Corinth, where there's other people who are baptizing on behalf of dead people, and that he's just saying, you know, even they think there's going to be life after this life. That's one possibility. And again, there's a lot of different ideas. Another idea, which I think is a plausible one as well, is that he's talking about other Christians who are being baptized in response to the hope of seeing resurrected loved ones who've already died. So that the idea there would be that a loved one has died who was a Christian, and then other people who weren't Christians, who were family members, later come to Christ and they're baptized. They come to faith and they're baptized, and part of it is out of the motive of knowing that they're going to be reunited with the dead ones. So they're not really baptizing in a way that's transferring to the dead person, but it's motivated by the idea that there's a loved dead one who was in Christ ahead of them.
Right.
So I don't know, maybe you have some other ideas that would make number 201, 202, and 203 of the different ideas, but I've heard all different interpretations of this, and people preach on it, and a lot of the 200 different versions, I'm not familiar with all 200, but of dozens of the different ideas, they don't really work, because a lot of the ideas people put forth to try and explain this don't really match what the text is saying. In other words, it the Greek is definitely saying that the people who are being baptized on behalf of the dead.
Right.
So a lot of the ideas that people put forth don't really take that grammar directly what it's saying. So however you want to interpret it, he's basically saying there are some people somewhere who are being baptized in light of the fact that they believe that the dead are going to rise.
Oh.
So it's a, you see what I'm getting at?
Yeah.
So how common would you say that belief of baptizing for the dead is in our culture today?
Well, in our culture today, I'm not that familiar with it. I've heard people say that Mormons have some practices along these lines, but yeah. I'm not that familiar with it.
No, they do.
Yeah.
Like, especially like those who are more Orthodox Mormon do.
And the idea would be that your baptism helps the person who's already dead?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And what is the purpose, I guess? Yeah.
You're baptizing yourself in place of somebody else who's already dead.
Oh, because they never
did. They never had the opportunity to get baptized.
So you're kind of making up.
Because the Mormons believe, at least the way it's been explained to me, Mormons believe that even after death, people still have the opportunity to get into heaven, or there's like several levels of heaven for them, and you have the opportunity to get into the lowest level and work your way up from there. So they baptize people for... people volunteer to be baptized for these dead people who didn't necessarily believe, but on the idea that it's getting them into that lower tier of paradise or heaven.
So it would be.
So that goes against that scripture that says you can't be a ransom for anyone, you can't be salvation for anyone. I can't think of how that word. Kind of like you can't be a ransom.
Yeah. One person can't pay for another
person's salvation.
Salvation, right. Yeah. And so that idea, the Mormon idea, would be I'm not saying the Roman Catholic Church says this, but it'd be similar to the idea of purgatory, where people are in a place where they're dead, but people who are still alive can do things for them.
Right. Well, they even think that the people in heaven can pray for them.
Really?
Yeah, you can both ways.
Right.
That's what I was taught when I was with a bunch of nuns there.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you know how much needs to be done? No. You don't. Because I was thinking, with the Mormons, it's more how, you know, different stages. Where this purgatory is kind of like one stage, but how much work has to be done to get you from that one stage to another.
You got to remember that Catholics believe the ones that do go there only have so-called venial sins.
Yeah.
The lesser sin, not mortal sin. Mortal sins, you're toast.
Oh.
But but venial sins, it's just kind of basically it's just an escape plan that they made up. Because you can't find it. I looked in the Douay version all over the place trying to find it and couldn't find it.
Yeah, I think they get it from the intertestamental books, where there's some mention of the idea of a place in between. So... those are books that are not considered part of the canon by the Protestant Church.
Right.
So that's how they established it outside of the canon, and that's the only way they could.
Yeah. So in the Catholic Bible, they have deuterocanonical books, or they call it a second canon. It's a canon within a canon.
Yeah.
It's a lesser canon.
Yeah,
Maccabees,
third, fourth,
and
fifth Kings, all kinds of stuff.
Daniel.
There's 72 books in the Catholic Bible.
Right.
Oh.
So
that's 72 minus 66 gives you
six.
So six extra ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyway, nobody knows exactly what's meant by that. There's a number of reasonable ideas, but I think it's easy to get so caught up that you lose the point of what Paul's trying to say, which is
I'm just curious how it applies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so in verse 30, it's really kind of the punchline of the Christian life, right? Why do we stand in jeopardy every hour? Why don't we just have a good time, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because if there is no resurrection, he already said we of all people are most miserable in this life,
mm-hmm.
right? He said that up above. He's kind of repeating that, saying, Christianity, the cost of Christianity wouldn't be worth incurring if there's no afterlife and no resurrection from the dead. And he kind of hints at the difficulties that he's faced as an apostle, right? He's in verse 31, I die daily. And I think if you look at the book of Acts and you look at Paul's ministry, there's times where he frequent times where he physically was at great danger, and other times where he has just a huge amount of stress. he's, I don't know if you want to call it stress, but he repeatedly says in numerous places that besides all these other physical things, he's concerned for all the churches. So even on the days when he isn't physically in a place of persecution, he's concerned, carrying a large weight.
Wasn't there one time when he actually did die?
Yeah. Well, there's discussions about whether he actually died or not when he was stoned.
Spoke of a man who, whether in his body or out of body,
Yeah, and there's disagreements about whether that's connected with when he was stoned or not, too. But yeah, he talks about he was stoned and dragged out of the city, and everyone thought he was dead. And the implication is that possibly he was. Because he does say something elsewhere that sounds very much like he could have been. So it's unclear whether or not he actually died and was raised, or whether or not it was really close to being dead. But he was definitely healed dramatically, because the next day he's walking around and everything later that day. But in 2 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians 1 verse 8, He talks about, he says, we do not want you to be ignorant, brethren. This is in 2 Corinthians 1, verse 8. We do not want you to be ignorant, brethren, of our trouble which came to us in Asia, that we were burdened beyond measure, above strength, so that we despaired even of life.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we had the sentence of death in ourselves, that we should not trust in ourselves but in God who raises the dead, who delivered us from so great a death and does deliver us, in whom we trust that he will still deliver us. So there's that whole reference to this time that he had. And there's one case where he's drug, I think it's out of Lystra, and another case in Ephesus with Diana of the Ephesians. He refers to beasts at Ephesus here, right?
Hmm.
And so that seems to be a reference to a situation in the book of Acts, where there was that whole business where Diana of the Ephesians, remember, where he's hauled into the Colosseum, and it was one of those intense mob situations that was diffused by, I think, the town clerk or something like that, but at the time it was looking like it wasn't going to go real well. And I think, isn't that in Acts 18 or something like that? 18 or 19? And I think what that is. See if I can find it here. It's the 19. It's a riot at Ephesus. It's called in mine. Acts 19:21 is where the section starts. In verse 23, about that time there arose a great commotion about the way, which is what Christianity was first called. A certain man named Demetrius, a silversmith who made silver shrines of Diana, brought no small profit to the craftsmen. He called together the workers of a similar occupation, basically said, look what's happening to our, you know, we're not selling a lot of these things. And verse 26, moreover, you see and hear that not only at Ephesus, but throughout almost all Asia, this Paul has persuaded and turned away many people, saying that they're not gods which are made with hands. So after he brings this up, they're full of wrath in verse 28, and the whole city is filled with confusion, and people that grab Paul, and or his companions actually, Paul's companions, and the disciples try to keep a hold of Paul, keep him away, and keep him out of the theater in verse 31. But basically, they haul him into this you know, stadium, more or less, and the whole place is going crazy. And then you can see in verse 33, one of the guys, Alexander, motioned with his hand, he wants to make his defense to the people, but when they heard out he was a Jew, they all started crying out, great is Diana of the Ephesians. And it's the city clerk in verse 35 who kind of brings things down back from the edge of disaster. You know these crowd dynamics, right? It's just unbelievable what people will do in a crowd, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So he doesn't end up getting into serious trouble there, but you can see where there was probably some roughness going on and people grabbing and yelling and screaming and all sorts of things potentially that were scary. So he's partly saying, you know, well, why in the world would I be going through all this stuff if I didn't think there was eternal life at stake? I mean, it doesn't make sense to take on all this risk and do all this stuff and travel on these missionary journeys and for, you know, he hasn't mentioned that, but forgoing Judaism and all that stuff that he was involved with, why in the world would you do that if there isn't a resurrection? So, I mean, that kind of applies to our own lives, right? Why on earth would you spend Monday night sitting in a little church on the south end of Camano Island when there's so many more interesting things to watch on TV? Right? And sit around and paw at a 2,000-year-old dusty book. I mean, you have to be crazy, right?
Yeah.
And why in the world on Sunday morning would you get up and go to church when you could go fish for bass? Or a million other things, right? I mean, right?
Yeah, that's what I thought, not that long ago.
Sure. And so, I mean, there's just, it. You know, we think Paul, you know, Paul is special, and the things he went through were unique for sure, but it really applies to our life too. Why do we spend all this time reading this Bible and in prayer? I mean, if you ask the average you know, a lot of people just don't even believe prayer does anything, right? I can remember when I was an unbeliever, hearing that all these people were going to go to the kingdom and pray for the whole day. I thought, what a stupid waste of time. Going there, sitting in the kingdom, nobody's listening, guys. Right? That's what I thought. I didn't believe in the spiritual realm. So, you know, there's a lot of things we do as Christians that if the Bible isn't true, they don't make any sense. Right?
Sure.
So, you know, that's part of what he's getting at here. He's saying, you know, this stuff is, if this isn't real, this resurrection isn't true, if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, then, you know, not, you know, we're spending a lot of time and a lot of effort on a dead end.
Well, I know. Remember, when we moved here and Mary started coming here, and before I was a believer, she very sheepishly one day said, "Do you mind if I give some money to the church or something?" And I said, "What?" It was just like the thought of giving your hard-earned money just basically away. You know, I mean, at least if you're like at a, I don't know, soup kitchen or something, you can see with your eyes that it's having some benefit to something, somebody. I was just like, what? I remember that, just like being appalled at the notion. Especially when she told me how much she wanted to give. Like, you know, it was like not $5. It was a substantial amount. It's like, I don't remember what it was, but I was like, what? Are you crazy? I work hard for that money.
When I was a young believer, I was kind of whining that way, and had an old guy come up to me, a believer. It's quiet.
Mm-hmm.
He goes, "Who are you giving it to, God or the church?" I had to make a decision there. He says, it'll take care of itself. Once he leaves your hand, it'll take care of itself. Why are you worried about it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, yeah, that's one of those examples, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, like he says in verse 32, back in 1 Corinthians 15, "If the dead do not rise, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die." And he's quoting a passage back in Isaiah where they're under siege.
Uh-huh.
Basically, this idea that there's nothing worth living for beyond the current time, you know. I did a memorial service not too long ago, and one of the things I was sharing in there was the different worldview between, you know, secular humanism and Christianity, and just the idea about if you don't believe there's anything coming in the future, just, you know, people don't think through how empty that really mm-hmm. is. You know, and it's interesting because it's easy to see right away that there's nothing really worth living for. But what people don't think about as much is there's nothing worth dying for either. Because if there's nothing beyond this life, there certainly isn't anything worth dying for. Because once you die, that's the ultimate loss, right? That's the end.
Carpe diem.
Yeah. So I mean, there's no. I would say, without the belief in an afterlife, you can't have an effective military. I think it's very hard to have an effective military. So who's gonna jump out of the foxhole in the middle of machine gun fire when there's no belief that there are principles that are greater than life?
I think people do, though.
They do. Some
valor,
people do.
Valor.
Yeah, valor. But, you know, it's kind of... The problem with a lot of those values that secular humanism tries to get people to strive for is they're ultimately empty, because when you really boil it down, it sounds good, but when you really boil it down, it's completely empty. Valor doesn't mean anything if there's no life beyond the grave. So it's just a weird thing when this whole business, "Let us eat and drink for tomorrow we die," because a lot of people that actually believe that's true, that there is no life beyond death, they're real quick to tell us that we should be moral individuals, right? That we should do these good deeds and you know, strive to be moral and everything else. But when you ultimately turn back and say, well, why? If I'm just naturally selected survival machine, right? Why should there even be morality? If I can produce more offspring, then I win. And I leave more offspring behind, I die, there's nothing in the future, and therefore you can't really provide a basis for morality. They'll always come back and say, well, yeah, there's got to be some morality, but really when there's no standard and there's no life beyond death, there really doesn't need to be any morality. There's no rationality for it.
Doesn't the Holy Spirit even work on non-believers too?
That's the problem, yeah. They know, they have a conscience still, and they have the law of God written on their heart, and so they know there is morality, but they're trying to reject God. They want to say there's no God, and then when you say, well, if there's no God, then there's no reason for morality, because good is just your opinion what's good, and I have a different opinion what's good, and mine's more like Attila the Hun, so too bad for you. And they have trouble with that, because like Jerry says, inside they know that can't be right, and they don't want that happening to them. They don't want that happening in the culture, but they don't have any logical basis for it.
Yeah, it's Romans 1 again, where basically everybody knows, but most people just choose to not, because they like where they are. They like living in sin, and so they choose not to believe that there's God.
Mm-hmm.
I guess.
Mm-hmm. If you listen to some of the, you know, like, trying to think if it's that video by Ben Stein, Expelled.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So one of the guys he interviews there is a professor of psychology, I think he is, at one of the universities in California, I think it was. And he was talking about, I think that's an interesting interview because it kind of shows how you can have a brilliant professor at a university who's on the edge of being a raving madman.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But he's super intelligent, and he's talking about how the fact that, well, you know, really we don't have any free will because we're just chemistry that's moving along. Our brains is just chemistry flowing along, and the decisions we make and everything, it's not because we make those decisions. It's just evolution just acting through all our chemical processes. And he goes on about the fact that, you know, there's absolutely no free will, and but he does it in a way where it's like, wow, this guy's kind of a nutcase, and people are paying huge amount of bucks to have their youngsters sent there to be trained by this guy, right? Because he's famous and all this. But when you listen to him, he's one of the more sane atheists in the sense that he's consistent. He's taking the thought that eat and drink for tomorrow we die, he's taking that to its logical conclusion and being consistent about it. Whereas most of the other ones that don't want to appear too nasty, they're preaching atheism, but then they're living in a way that denies their belief, or at least compromises it in certain ways. Anyway, I just think it's interesting because Paul in this passage kind of goes right for that whole idea. He's basically saying that the Christian life is an antithesis to the life of an atheist, or a life of somebody who doesn't believe in that there's a future. There's no future accountability, there's no resurrection. It's just, you know, it just comes to an end and there's nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if you take that view, it just undermines, you don't have anywhere you came from, you have nothing really to live for, and you're not going anywhere. And all the wisdom and experience you learn in this life is all just a snuffed out candle. It's a waste. You know, it's pretty depressing when you really wrestle with the implications. So even just as a non-Christian, it has all kinds of negatives. And Paul's saying, well, you guys aren't even out surfing and playing golf and having parties every night and eating steaks every night. I mean, you guys are having prayer and going to church and, you know, abstaining from things that you don't believe are godly, and you're sitting studying the Bible, and you're not out, you know, fishing on your boat and sending all these different things you could be doing, and it doesn't make sense to do any of that unless he rose from the dead. And not just the fact that he rose from the dead, but that there is an afterlife. that there is life beyond the grave. Is essentially what he's bringing up. And I know before I was a believer, I didn't really believe there was anything beyond the grave, but I don't think I ever really sat and thought through the implications of it. But you know how you are when you're young, right? You're so full of yourself, and you think your thinking is so smart, and you're so stupid you haven't really thought through half of what you think you know, right? And it's just, you know, it's arrogance. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I'm sure you could identify with it, some things I've heard you talk about. And I see it completely that way. You know, later. No, I'm just saying that
completely.
A bunch of things you've said in the past resonate with me because we have a similar outlook on a lot of things.
Yeah.
So there's this whole thing where you just, when you see these passages, for someone like me, it takes me back to before I was a believer, and now being a believer and looking back at that mindset, I can just see how, you know, in a sense, when people say, well, why is society self-destructing? You know, why are there so many suicides? Why are there so many cases now where fathers kill their whole family and then kill themselves? I mean, we never used to see that, or hardly ever, and now it's fairly common.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why are there so many kids that have no purpose to live for? You know, it all comes back to this business where we're designed to be a certain way, and the teaching of the culture in the schools is teaching a poisonous philosophy that causes people to self-destruct.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you teach people who are designed to worship God and to have a future and have a purpose, when you teach them ultimately, yeah, we're teaching the evolution in this, and we got all these neat names for it in science and everything. But, you know, if you're a smart kid and you boil it down, at the base we're teaching you, you're nothing. You have no purpose. Life is meaningless, and there's no judgment. So it's just this empty vacuum blackness. That's life. I hope you enjoy it. And by the way, when you graduate, make something of yourself.
Yeah.
You know? Change the world.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's kind of hard as a Christian to listen to the valedictorian.
Yeah.
If they're not a Christian, you know, because you want to go up and shake them and say, you liar. You're up there trying to motivate us, and you're teaching us there's no purpose to be motivated for. You know, and meanwhile, they trot all these psychologists on the TV every time something happens. They say, well, why do you think that happened? And nobody says, well, because we're teaching people that there's no purpose in life, and it's extremely depressing, and they're self-destructing.
And it is kind of sad. Like, when I was in high school, you know, it was not too long after they started having more and more, you know, school shootings and, you know, teenagers committing suicide and stuff. Because, you know, by that time, by high school, about high school, they've been taught that for quite a few years yet. And, you know, sad to think, but the ones that do those kinds of things are the ones that actually figured it out. They've come to the logical conclusion. I mean, like, and they've gone back and they've, you know, looked at some of the things they wrote in their diaries or they talked about with their friends or parents or teachers or whatever, and they, like, and these kids, it's so, kids, you know, they're somewhat more perceptive than people give them credit for a lot of the time, because, you know, they're in that stage of life where they're just
learning
everything. Mm-hmm. They're taking it all in. And those kids that did that, sad as it may seem, are the ones who actually figured out
where it leads.
The bottom line of it is that, why do anything? What's the point of anything? And it's depressing. It is sad. Because that's the conclusion they come to. There's no point in life, and so they do these horrible things. And it's, in the end, though, it's a logical conclusion of what they've been taught.
And because when you look at the stages of depression all the way down, the bottom line is no hope.
Mm-hmm.
And when they have no hope, that's when they get self-destructive.
You touched on one thing that resonates with me that you kind of said you were headed, I think you would have, you said that we're designed to worship, we're designed to praise the Lord, and really that ultimately, and when you put self on the throne, that's when you'll, instead of God on the throne, that's when you'll see a lot of this depression, emptiness. Even as a Christian, if you put self on the throne, you will be, you're going to be disappointed in life. It's only when you put God on the throne is when you'll see, when you can possibly have the real joy that God talks about.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. I think that worship is an interesting thing, too, because it's something as a Christian that, when you've been a Christian for a while, you don't think twice about it, and it's a wonderful part of your experience. But to a non-Christian, it really can really freak people out. I know my dad, when I became a Christian, and one of the things I did, I went on a mission trip to Colombia, and when I came back, showed some photos from the trip, and there was some photos where I was in the middle of worship. We were in the middle of a worship situation, and it really, really, really bothered him to see me worshiping. And it really hit me then, because I never really thought about it. But sometimes as a Christian, seeing how other people react to things that you don't pay much attention to makes you think again, what is it about that? I mean, my dad didn't like the fact that I became a Christian, but what was it about that made him like crawl out of his chair, right, when he saw it? And it's the idea, to him, the idea that you would worship something, someone greater. In his mind, that's like, he's thinking, you know, Aztecs sacrificing people on rocks. Or, you know, I mean, he's got...
Pagan worship.
He's got all these... Yeah, and in his mind, worship is fundamentally pagan. There is no other kind of worship in his mindset, right? There's nothing worth worshiping. Man's the apex, right? So to see someone like your son, who you think has half a foot on the ground, you know, doing something so completely nonsensical in his mind, irrational.
Yeah.
I mean, worship is, without the truth of the Bible, worship is irrational, right? You know,
yeah.
So there's that whole issue. And, I remember even when I first became a believer, I think, you know, for 3 or 4 months, or maybe 6 months, I would go to church and be a worship service. Even though I was saved in the middle of worship service, I'd be in a worship service and people would be talking about their love for Jesus and stuff. And I was like, Jesus is God. God's big. He's huge. He's powerful. But I don't get this love thing. I had trouble with it. It took me a while, you know. But so there's just a lot of things in the Christian life that are there are things that we know, but you can't see. Faith-based, or we have the foundation of it, but you know, you can't see God. You can see effects from God, but you can't see God. And so this idea that you're living with the idea that you're going to be living beyond the grave, that there's an eternity that you're going to be useful for and being prepared for, that all the way up to your last breath, there's not a day wasted. It's all being invested in you and you're eternal. That makes, I mean, that's just a huge difference in how you live life. And people that don't have that view of something beyond the end, don't, you know, they just don't have that. And I'm just going to say, it's just something you don't think about every day, but when you sit down and talk with people, you start to see how it comes out.
I think people who don't have a father, or, you know, mm-hmm. a father, or had a mean dad, you know, somebody beat them all the time or whatever, or didn't pay any attention to them, I think they have a hard time, the concept of loving a father, of loving Father in heaven, and loving in return. So that I've heard people talk about that before. I don't know what the answer is, unless maybe it's the fact
agape love is choosing to love somebody and not responding to feelings or whatever. It's a choice. God chooses to love us no matter what we are. In fact, He chooses to love us when we're
enemies.
Yeah, when we're something that He can't stand. You know, He can't stand when we're against sin. So it's, that concept there kind of is what's entered my life. You know, I didn't really have a dad growing up. And so love for just seemed to be, where is it? You know, I be very honest with you, I still have that problem. It's not, I see people that seem to be really worshiping, you know, really. And I'm in that sometimes, you know, because it's a hard thing to get into. And of course, that's my excuse. you know, it's only excuse I can think of. But I think it's true with more people. Just
mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not an excuse. It's just, you know, how you're wired, you know, and how what your life was before, and you know, there's a lot of elements to it.
We're a sum of a lot of parts, a lot of things, everything that happened to us in the past, and everything around us, and everything. So,
yeah, my experience of worship is untimely. It comes at strange times, not typically at a church service.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it can be just something, I'm home alone or I'm listening to some music, and just other times it's an emotional thing. I'm pleased by it, but it's not just like this really emotional thing typically for me at church. I don't know why. Maybe I'm a little bit like you.
Well, you're leading worship.
Yeah, you're leading worship.
So yeah, but even if I'm not, I'm typically find myself distracted by, because I am a musician, so I'm listening to the music.
Yeah.
Probably a little more technically. I don't want to do that. It's not like I'm critical, like, oh, you guys are this or that. It's not that, but my worship just personally comes at other times. And it catches me by surprise. I don't set out to it. You know, that's just kind of my experience of it.
Mm-hmm.
Mine's the church. When you're not thinking about worship, I'm worshiping. So, thank
you.
That's
awesome. That's
you worship at home, I'll worship here when you're playing.
Yeah.
Where I grew up, though, worship was controlled. With the Catholic Church, okay, everybody bow. Everybody do this.
Yeah.
Everybody say this. Everybody, it was controlled. It was controlled. And to the point now where I go, I don't want anything that even resembles that.
Yeah, yeah. Because it's not real worship. It's just movement.
Start at 11, you're out at 12.
Yeah.
We'll cut this short. You know, we'll run through the communion really quick here and get you guys out. Because, let's see, 15 minutes, we got another batch of people coming in. You know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, it's a big topic, for sure. So there's this... What's interesting about it, though, I think, is that everyone who's a Christian has, I think, could share things that are real valuable for them that happen in the setting of a church fellowship, and then a lot of things that happen that aren't. And I think that's really good, too, because Christianity is a 24/7 thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just when you're in church. So, you know, some of the real powerful things that God might do in your life aren't necessarily going to happen in the church. They
yeah.
happen anywhere, for sure. So, any other comments on that general topic before we go back to the text? Shall we read the next section?
Okay.
So I was thinking 35 to 49.
I'll read that.
Yeah?
35 through 49.
Okay.
But someone will say, how are the dead raised up? And with what body do they come? Foolish one, what you sow is not made alive unless it dies. And what you sow, you do not sow that body that shall be. but mere grain, perhaps wheat or some other grain. But God gives it a body as he pleases, and to each seed its own body. All flesh is not the same flesh, but there is one kind of flesh of men, another flesh of animals, another of fish, and another of birds. There are also celestial bodies and terrestrial bodies, but the glory of the celestial is one, and the glory of the terrestrial is another. There is one glory of the sun, another glory of the moon, another glory of the stars, for one star differs from another star in glory. So also is the resurrection of the dead. The body is sown in corruption, it is raised in incorruption.
Hallelujah.
Yeah, no kidding. It is sown in dishonor, it is raised in glory. It is sown in weakness, it is raised in power. It is sown a natural body, it is raised a supernatural body. There is a natural body and there is a spiritual body. And so it is written, the first man, Adam, became a living being. The last Adam became a life-giving spirit. However, the spiritual is not first, but the natural, and afterward the spiritual. The first man was of the earth, made of dust. The second man is the Lord from heaven, and was the man of dust. And as was the man of dust, so also are those who are made of dust. And as is the heavenly man, so also are those who are heavenly. And as we have borne the image of man of dust, we shall also bear the image of the heavenly man.
Right. A lot there, huh?
Yeah.
So he's trying to answer the question, some of the questions about how people are raised and what does it look like, what's their body like, and so forth. And he probably raises as many questions as it answers. So it just kind of moves the questions to elsewhere. So how does it compare the body that's sown with the body that's raised? What are some of the comparisons that you see?
The body is sown in corruption.
Okay. And it's raised
in corruption.
In corruption. So that's one of the very important parts, right? That it's not like we're getting another body that then that one's going to go south and we're going to get a third and that goes south and we get a fourth. It's just a one-time situation that the resurrection body is incorruptible. What else?
Every time I read this, I see how far sin has pushed us. You know, how corrupt we are and then what we could have had. If nothing like what Adam and Eve. If Adam and Eve had done what they were supposed to, it would have been a whole different world.
Yeah. Because Adam was of the dust before he fell.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So being of the dust itself is not corruption.
Right.
Dishonor to glory.
Yeah, so the one's dishonor and the other is glorified or glory. So it says glory a lot in here. Mm-hmm. What do you think it's getting at there? How would you kind of put your finger on glory?
Yeah, we define glory a little more clearly. Right? Mm-hmm.
What's the original?
Doxa, it's like doxology. It's a Greek word, doxa. And in the Old Testament, it's chabad, which is, it basically means reputation, weight. You know, as in a sumo wrestler, you know, someone who's heavy. Able to do things, powerful, substance, reputation, has all those ideas.
That's the definition. I was trying to look at it real quick.
What does it say?
I couldn't go that fast.
Oh, okay. But, yeah, so So often in the scriptures, in the New Testament especially, we think of glory in you know, how bright God is and mm-hmm. shining.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in its symbol of his presence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But in the Old Testament, it has a lot more of an idea. It's more of an emphasis of reputation and weight and ability.
When I read it, though, I think of Moses, and after he saw the passing of the Lord,
mm-hmm.
and how, you know, or when he talked to him, it basically the glory
right.
that was pushed off onto him, and he had shown that it finally faded away
mm-hmm.
because he came back to corruption. But, yeah, and then I see that as a continuous thing. Yeah, once we do that, it'll never go away.
We know there is a connection between the idea of glory and being bright and light. Because like on the Mount of Transfiguration, right, Jesus is revealed in his glory.
Mm-hmm.
And when it talks about the sign of the coming of what's it, the sign of the Son of Man, right, as the lightning flashes from the east to the west,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it's implying definitely, and like Sid brought up, there's all kinds of places in the Old Testament where the glory of the Lord, his revealed presence, is definitely associated with a blinding light. It's like Paul on the road to Damascus,
mm-hmm.
same sort of thing. It was midday, something brighter than the sun. So it's got this whole thing wrapped up together, all these different ideas about something super powerful, bright, shining.
Like fullness.
Fullness.
The fullness of God
mm-hmm.
emanates. You know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's kind of like holy. It's a very complex concept too, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Holy has different emphasis too. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's emphasizing purity and sometimes it's emphasizing uniqueness. There's all different aspects to it. And I think glory is the same way. It's hard to,
mm-hmm.
it's kind of like pinning down jello. You know, there's, it's got a lot of different aspects to it, and in different passages, different attributes of glory are emphasized more than another. But clearly, man is going to be, well, it says here we're going to bear the image of the heavenly man,
mm-hmm.
right? And the heavenly man we know is Jesus. So that's pretty amazing.
See, that's what I was thinking about when we talk about the millennial reign.
Mm-hmm.
People know, how are we going to tell? We're going to stand out. There's going to be no doubt in anybody's mind who we are.
It would seem that way, you know, although there's cases where, again, it's hard to put your finger, but like angels, right, where
mm-hmm.
you can't tell they're not men, and Jesus at times
yeah.
was in
yeah.
places.
But by choice.
Yeah, by choice, that's right. So it could be it's going to be real evident all the time, or it might be it's not. It's hard to say, but for sure, it's going to be obvious, I think, as far as when it talks about the capabilities,
mm-hmm.
you know, incorruptible. How could you be sitting next to a person who's incorruptible and not know it?
And,
you
yeah,
know?
That's
yeah. You know, like I like to ask the question, if Jesus had never gone to the cross, would he ever have had gray hair? Because the wages of sin are death.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't have the wages of sin. So is he going to ever have gray hair and crummy vision? I hope not, right? But, I mean, we never know that answer because...
Well, he did age.
He aged, but, you know, was he dying? Was he in the process of dying? I don't think you
no.
can say he was.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you do, then he's paying the wages without going to the cross yet, you know? So I don't know. I mean, that's kind of like,
yeah.
did Adam and Eve have a belly button, right? It's the same sort of dumb question.
But if Adam and Eve hadn't sinned, they would have still been living. You know, you think
mm-hmm.
about that.
Mm-hmm.
So in the visions of Jesus where he has, or the Ancients of Days where he has white hair and all that, that's mostly speaking about purity and wisdom and
yeah.
all this other stuff. But I guess one of the biggest questions that comes up in this whole thing that people ask a lot, and I don't know how you can answer it really very well, is, you know, what are you going to look like, right?
Yeah.
You know, what stage of life will you look like in? You know, there's all these questions that come up, like when a baby dies that's going to be in heaven, what age
they're
going to be
forever.
I would say they're not probably going to be a baby forever, but I don't know for sure, right? And then, you know, there's all these questions that come up, you know, about exactly how do you recognize people? I mean, there's just a ton of practical everyday questions that come up when you start thinking more along these lines. You know, the answer that comes back 90% of it is, well, God will do the right thing and it'll all work out. But boy,
that's a lot of
questions.
Theory, huh? It'll all work out.
It'll all pan out. Yeah, that's right. Got to throw it in the pan.
I do have a quick question on glory itself. Is that more of an, I don't know if the word amoral is a very good term for it, but glory isn't always good. Isn't we think of glory as good, but there's been a lot of really rotten people who had their time of glory. And so I just want to, you know, glory in a sense.
Right.
We prefer looking at the glory of the Lord and the bright wonderfulness of it, but there's a lot of evil, awful things done in and so glory is sometimes something we have to...
Well, I think he's talking about the idea that people get glory even though they're wicked. You know, glory is this
glory
idea of people giving glory. You know, like...
So that's a false glory in God's point of view,
wouldn't
right?
it come along the same lines as famous and infamous?
Yeah, possibly, I guess.
Yeah.
Glory and inglory.
Yeah, a lot of
Caesars
had their...
We would say they had their glory, but their glory was, it was man's glory, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, in which point of view? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
From man's point of view, it looks glorious to them.
Right, but they did really have, they did have some aspects of glory. They had power and influence and, you know, so there are ways. They had reputation, you know, like the Antichrist, he's the beast, right? I mean, he has a reputation. It's not, so I don't know, I haven't really, you know, I haven't done a story, a study of all the different uses of glory, but I think it is worth noting that there's an issue where God declares things to be glorious, and then there's where people give glory, right? It's like there's a place where Moses is talking to Achan, I think it is, about the accursed thing that he takes, and he says something like, give God glory and confess what you did.
Well, there's the glory of God and the glory of man, and so I think that's the two differences in the, in the word. So if we're looking at the glory of man, we're looking at it through earthly, in our earthly perspective, and if it's the glory of God, then we're looking at it through heavenly perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Well, was there any demons or Lucifer, did he demonstrate his glory and who he was? Did he ever have an established glory in it?
Well, to start with, I think, yeah, I think if you look at the passages that talk about the king of Tyre and what's the other king? I can't think now right now.
Sidon.
Babylon, is it? Tyre and Babylon? I think.
Nimrod?
No, but the passages that talk about Satan, Ezekiel 28 and Isaiah 14, I think it is, where he starts out talking to a particular king, and then he kind of goes past the king to Lucifer, star of the morning. But he calls him, you know, son of the morning star.
Of course, we don't know when, you know, it said iniquity was founded, and we don't know when that happened.
Right.
You know, it could have been past that time,
right,
when it was talking about how
glorious
his temples were so great and, and all that.
Yeah. So there's a whole issue of, you know, when Satan fell, you know, can he still represent himself in certain ways or not? And it's hard to know. It's hard to know. I mean, the angels are referred to in some places as stars. You know, it implies the ability to shine and give off power. I don't know. You know, but yeah, it's an interesting area. But the whole thing about weakness versus power, dishonor versus glory, you know, dishonor being this idea of, again, of something that's not worthy or you don't really want people to see, and the other side is something that's very strong and you're not embarrassed to have people see it because it's glorious. And then it talks about natural and spiritual, but it still is talking about a body.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting thing there too.
But this must be just talking about a saved person, not an unsaved person. Because an unsaved person wouldn't be raised spiritual, right?
Well, yeah, not in the case of what it talks about, the last Adam became a life-giving spirit.
Yeah.
People who are not in Christ are not going to be in that situation. Yeah. So as we talked about, I mean, they are resurrected, and they do exist eternally.
Of course, there's going to be a resurrection of the dead at the great white throne,
mm-hmm.
and that those bodies, this won't apply to. I mean, part of it would.
Yeah, the raised, but
yeah.
Yeah, but I don't think you can say when you look at the New Testament the idea that an unsaved person would be connected with Christ in any sense of that spiritual aspect.
I was going to say we may have said it, but even an aspect now we carry it. You ever have somebody just not like you? They're not believers, but they have some. They just have some disdain about you, about mm-hmm. me, and you ain't even said anything to them. They
yeah.
just don't like you, and I mean it's not a personality conflict because mm-hmm. you haven't even met them, really.
No, right. There's definitely a the whole idea that you're in one kingdom and they're in another,
mm-hmm.
and you know where it talks about the aroma of life leading to life and the aroma of death leading to death or whatever, that this and who's equal to that, that whole idea that they're, you know, I've had that experience too where you go somewhere and you're pretty convinced that what you're seeing is a spiritual reaction to the fact that you're a Christian and it's not really you because it's off the scale and you can't explain it really any other way. So yeah, especially, I mean, there are, you know, we see in the scriptures there are people who are influenced and controlled by demonic powers. And just like the, you know, legion, you know, the demons know who Jesus is. They know that eventually they're going to be in the abyss, you know. So there's spiritual discernment. I don't know if you want to call it discernment or spiritual sensitivity that people who are demonically influenced have. That goes beyond natural capabilities.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how much you want to say it.
I was thinking of another one, Pastor, where he says, Paul, I know. And,
yeah.
and he was calling out who he knows, and but I don't know you.
Yeah.
and who you are. You know,
yeah.
And so I can't remember where that's at.
That's
right.
The seven sons of Sceva, the
yeah.
Jewish priest, that they go to try to exorcise the demon, and he overpowers them. So they're definitely... I mean, it's not like we see those things all the time, but, you know, I wasn't really a party to it specifically, but when I was in Bogota in the next room, these pastors were in there trying to do what they thought was an exorcism, and it was wild. I mean, it was a woman, and people and things were flying all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a brand new Christian. I just stayed out of it. But... just to say, you know, it's around, the Bible talks about it's real, and the little hints we see is that when people are influenced that way, they have spiritual perception about, like, who was Messiah, or, you know, and also extreme strength.
Isn't the gift of spiritual discernment,
mm-hmm.
isn't that what that involves? Being able, as a Christian, to be able to discern... demonic activities or something like that.
It would seem that that's what the gift is described as being in 1 Corinthians, you know, the idea that a person can discern spiritual truths that aren't evident.
So some people would have that gift, possibly, and other people wouldn't have it, since we don't all have all the gifts.
In the list of gifts, it's just one of the ones that's listed in there, and when you when you look at, you know, like if you look at, I think it's in Isaiah, I'm trying to remember where it is in Isaiah, but one of the things where it talks about the characteristics of the Messiah, it talks about he will not judge with his eyes, and not by his hearing, and not by what he sees. And so the implication is that he's going to discern spiritual truth, and you see situations in the scriptures where it talks about, what was I going to say? Just the idea that, you know, it's like when Elijah, or it's Elisha, where they're surrounded on the hills.
Elisha.
And he says, so there's definitely situations in the scripture where people, where the spiritual realm is, people are allowed to see aspects of the spiritual realm which we normally wouldn't be able to see. But, so
the point is, it works both ways.
Yeah. So, you know, I think sometimes as a new believer, maybe, I mean, I can remember being we used to have a Bible study at a different house, and one of the women there, we were going through the book of Matthew, I think it was, and we got to some section where I think it was Legion or something, and we were teaching through that, and partway through she looked up and she said, "You really believe in demons?" And I says, "Yeah." You know, but she's been a Christian a long time, and she says, I don't know what she does with those passages, but she just didn't think that stuff was real. And you know, there's other Christians that are just drawn to that and always want to be immersed in it. But but I think it's the scriptures tell us what they do, and they leave the rest of it, you know, and it's pretty clear that we're not to be afraid of it, but we're also not to be dabbling in it. And so, you know, this whole business, once you start finding about resurrection, you get into the whole created order thing, because you have, we have a natural body, we're going to be resurrected, and man is different than the angels. Angels are ministering spirits, they can materialize. Some fallen spirits seek embodiment, right?
Mm-hmm.
Demons. There's that whole issue that raises a bunch of questions as well. So when you start looking at the full spiritual creation of God, all the way from just the plain material to the just pure spirit, there's a lot of different aspects to it, and it's a realm where we get these little passages like this that tell us a little bit about transformations and aspects of what our body would be like, which points in the direction of being more like, you know, how angels are powerful and do things.
I think, how Jesus appeared in the room. Now, I was wondering, and of course, probably there's no indication of it, but since we will get a resurrection body and we'll be like him,
mm-hmm.
isn't it very possible that we'll be able to do that? That we'll be able to say, if we want to go to Jupiter or Mars, we can just do it, you know? I mean, why not? I mean,
mm-hmm.
because Jesus mm-hmm. appeared out on the road of Emmaus and on the way to Emmaus, and so that would be a neat thing to think about.
Well, it leads to another question, though. It has to be addressed real quick. I don't want to be the rabbit here, but if with a glorified body, we are incapable of sinning, right? Once mm-hmm. we have a glorified body.
Yes.
But nowhere have I read it doesn't say that we can't make a mistake. Because a mistake isn't necessarily a sin.
Yeah, I think that could be a big discussion.
That could be a tough one, yeah.
We'll be like Jesus. We'll be like him. Now, did Jesus ever make a mistake? Anybody want to ask yourself?
We're going to have a closeness that we're not used to.
But we're not.
Why do you bring out
that question?
Well, because
of the mistake you made.
It's just as it's having a glorified body. The fact that Jesus coming back, if
this is the millennium kingdom,
I mean,
and we're here, what
you can't,
and Jesus is on the throne, all these people with glorified bodies are at that time. Who's to say that even with a glorified body that you aren't, you are not capable of sinning against God? He relieves us from this burden. But I have seen nothing that makes me think that we can't still make mistakes.
Yeah, but you know, if you go, you know, if you go back, and again, I don't know if we should get into it because it's a huge topic. But if you go back,
I thought.
there's a whole issue of what is sin. It's missing the mark and your mark, but it's and there's sins committed in ignorance, and there's still sins. And, you know, it's a huge topic. Exactly what our situation will be, but I think most people would say that we won't make mistakes.
We're incapable of even making a form of mistake, even at that point.
I think you have to determine what is a mistake. What is
what is a mistake?
I mean, because
sinning
is a mistake.
Yeah.
Okay, that's making an unpardonable mistake. We'll no longer even be influenced by sin. So.
But that's not it. A sin is a mistake, but that's not the consequence. A sin is if you're turning your back on God, you're turning. It's different.
Are you talking about mistakes like please pass the salt and knock it over, that kind of stuff? I mean,
that's raising the question.
Is that really a mistake? That was the point of my question.
Yeah, I think. I guess that's why I wasn't really wanting to get into it, because I think you have to do a lot of groundwork to establish with clarity what really is a mistake and what isn't a mistake, and there's still the whole issue of. There's a lot of sin that isn't wanton sin. It's still sin. Sins of omission, for example, would be considered a mistake. You know, things that you're not even aware of. I mean, you're not knowingly doing it against God, but it's still a sin, according to the Old Testament. So I think it's a big area with a lot of subtleties.
Mm-hmm.
To really nail it down. I think it's a good question, but I don't know that we can solve it right now.
I think we're told that when we see him, we'll be like him, and you know, that covers a lot of territory right there. It's you know, not that we'll be God, but we will be.
Yeah, because it's the word life.
We will be children of God.
Life.
You know, we will be adopted sons of God at that time. I mean, I'm not even sure we might be now, but to make the mistake, but we're having. Got rid of our flesh and body.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have a heavenly body.
I'm not saying it is true or not.
No, I'm just
pointing out the fact that I've never read anywhere it says that when a glorified state of any kind that we wouldn't be capable of mistakes. Otherwise, why aren't the angels winning absolutely everything? Why is there still fight spiritually?
I don't think you can say that. Shows that they're making mistakes, though.
Just shows that
shows
God's
differences
purpose.
In power
so
and the purposes.
Okay.
Right, and we're different. But the angels, the elect angels, are clearly portrayed as being sinless.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
All right.
It's a big area for sure. And David, you had good hand.
Now you know she's got that round of loaded.
I don't know if this will be helpful or not, but I tend to think that we wouldn't make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
Not that, I mean...
Who wants to?
That's what I mean, that's the point. If who wants to? You regret your mistakes. And then it says there will be no more
sorrow,
no more tears, no more regret. So, why would we make mistakes? So why would God want us to still be able to make?
You know, part
of the stuff is the eternal state, though.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have glorified bodies, you're still in the millennial kingdom. You know?
Not necessarily.
Saying,
that's what you have from there forward, period, forever, glorified body, right? But the thing about it, part of what we struggle with, I think, is. We're like a bunch of fish living at the bottom of the deep sea floor talking about what a bird is.
Yeah.
right?
Yeah, I agree.
Right? So we're down there in one of those deep sea vents, mm-hmm. crawling around like those little crab things in the dark. And there's, you know, there's eagles soaring above the mountains in the sunlight. And they're both real, but try to tell one of those fish, right, what it's like to be an eagle. And you could sit down there as a little crab on the bottom and talk about what you think a bird might be like. And some of it's worthwhile, but at some point it's just like we're so stuck in sin.
Mm-hmm.
We're stuck in weakness. We're stuck in uncertainty. We're stuck in lack of trust. We're stuck in misty understanding. We're so immersed in that muck that to really understand what are we going to be like when we're glorified.
Yeah.
It's like...
pretty hard.
It's hard.
It is.
You know, and I go back to my overworn thing where I say, you know, it's like designing a doghouse on a computer CAD and then trying to tell your dog how you did it, right? It's just like, there's such a disconnect. It's like...
I wouldn't think Adam and Eve made mistakes until they went, until they ate of the tree and until they sinned. And that's when... their mistakes started. I don't think they made mistakes.
But you have to say all mistakes sin, because
I think that's true.
That's what I was saying, why you have to spend a lot of time defining what
because
you think these terms mean.
Because sin is what causes it. It doesn't mean that it's a sin against God or anything to make a mistake, but sin is what causes all of our problems. It causes all of our sicknesses. It causes death. It causes everything. And so... without sin, I think,
mm-hmm.
I think it's very possible we wouldn't make any mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a toughie. You always ask these tough
today.
Questions, don't you? You got the rabbit for good reason.
That was a big rabbit.
It's
an interesting question to talk about.
Yeah.
It's,
yeah.
There's nothing wrong with talking about
no.
it. Knowing you will not nail this down.
No.
No,
that's
way.
Right.
You know, and... our perspective, like you said, is so trapped and housed in our flesh. Just even our perspective about what a mistake is, you know, that some can be relative, you know, because a mistake to someone is not necessarily a mistake to someone else. So there's so many parameters, dynamics to
but
it.
But our whole
question like
when you think that our minds are going to be completely changed, we're not even going to be really out of our own experience anymore. I mean, bad stuff is not going to be, because that's got to go. All that's got to go to heaven. And so your thinking's altogether going to be different.
Yes.
Has to be.
Yeah.
Look forward to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do too.
Believe me, I'm looking forward to it.
Sorry, Tony.
No, it's a good, it's a real good question. I think your question is also illustrative of a whole class of questions that come up about eternity and about various aspects of the future. Because, I mean, even we've had some discussions before about the issue where it basically talks about no more sorrow and no more
mm-hmm.
tears and so on, and then the question comes up, well, Jesus has these scars in his body, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's all these questions about how much will we remember.
Mm-hmm.
I know you've brought that up several times as well. And there's these questions that come up where the scriptures barely hint at answering them, and you almost don't know how to answer them, you know. But they're valid questions, and they're things that you can ponder about. But it's almost like in some cases, well, a lot of those cases, there's two things. One is we don't have that much information, and the second is we're so far removed from what that reality is
mm-hmm.
that it's it's really hard for us to draw conclusions about it, you know. And I think Riley and I were talking yesterday about fiction, you know, or science fiction or whatever, and I was mentioning in the course of the conversation that before I was a Christian, I was always a little bit disappointed because back in my past, I'd read a lot of fiction and science fiction stuff, and I always thought, it's so frustrating. The reality is so much below, you know, creativity and fiction. And then when you get in the Bible, you see that, no,
yes.
that creativity
yeah.
and that
mm-hmm.
imagination that God has given you, he's actually got things beyond that.
Yeah.
That reality is cooler than imagination, you know, as opposed to feeling like God's given us this ability to imagine this wonderful things, perfection and this and that and the other, and we'll never see it. So you kind of go from being kind of a disappointed idealist to thinking, oh yeah, this is going to blow away even mm-hmm. our most amazing ideas. And that's where, to me, I just feel like I kind of go back and forth. I get lured into thinking a lot about it, mm-hmm. and then pretty quickly run into a bunch of brick walls trying to figure things out. And then it's like I just kind of fall back and go, ah.
Yeah.
Another rabbit. Maybe you could answer a question for me.
No.
What was it meant when God was saying when God dispersed the at Babel, you know, the language, I mean, confound the languages, and he said, if nothing is done, nothing can be kept from them.
Mm-hmm.
What did he mean by that? I mean, that's not the exact words, but mm-hmm. but it was. To me, it sounded like they'd be able to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they were all left of one mind and one language,
mm-hmm.
there was nothing that they could be stopped from doing.
Yeah. I think he was just saying that the creative potential in man is absolutely immense, and that whether it's evil or good, there's a, you know, part of being made in his image is the ability to learn and grow and create. And I'll use this word because I think it applies, evolve things. Where there's intelligence, you can have evolution.
Mm.
But without intelligence, you can't. But we evolve airplanes, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right? Designs, we improve them. We,
mm-hmm.
But they don't just happen by chance. But the idea that man and his will and the ability that God gave him, made in the image of God as opposed to the animals, that man could achieve things that go far beyond what it appeared at that time, but in the case of evil things, they could go far beyond as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think part of what he was, saying is that I've gifted man in pretty strong ways, and if I don't do something mm-hmm. to get in the way of that,
slow it down,
it's going to be big trouble.
So maybe what he was saying echoed what you were saying earlier about the science fiction and the ideas of man and
right.
how they seem to
bring
surpass
to reality. Right.
Maybe that there's truth in that.
Right.
And I mean, you do see a lot of science fiction that becomes science fact.
Right.
Like
virtual reality would, you know, this is interesting that you bring this up because one of the big areas right now is building headsets that
mm-hmm.
people wear to give 360-degree sight and sound, you know, virtual reality, and the idea there is to go beyond the real world to the imaginary world in a way that's completely immersed and realistic, and the limits are only what man's mind, right,
yeah,
can come up with, good and bad,
right.
So then you can take that and put it into what we were talking about earlier about our resurrection body and what we may be capable of
in
that resurrection body.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when we're told we only use a very small portion of our brain,
mm-hmm.
and you know, if we start using our full brain, and we're all of one mind, we're all of Jesus's mind at that time, and,
mm-hmm.
and so to speak. And if who knows? I mean, it could be. I mean, it's going to be something fantastic. The Bible
right.
says that. And so it's something
that's a good point, yeah.
It's a neat thing to think about.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm a big believer that, you know, he's only revealed what he wants to reveal so far because, mm-hmm. I mean, we have a purpose in this life, but we have a purpose way beyond that, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We're not going to be just sitting playing harps.
No,
as long as I get a minor key harp, I'll be fine.
Yeah.